This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We've spent a lot of time on our show recently considering whether building sports stadiums with public money is a good idea. Whether it's a plan to bring minor league baseball to Hartford, which seems like kind of small potatoes, considering the ongoing World Cup in Brazil, where spending on soccer stadiums, not public services, had citizens protesting in the streets. These same questions keep coming up. Do investments like these provide economic stimulus or jobs? Do they raise the city's profile or spark new investment? There's nothing quite like the orgy of spending, though, and the breathless cheerleading that accompanies the Olympic Games. Time was that cities jockeyed for position to try and land the Games, summer or winter, but it seems now it's a tougher sell. Why? Well, there's the cost, a cool $51 billion this year in Russia. And then there are the stories from Athens to Atlanta, Sydney to Sochi, where what was once desirable has become a sort of disaster. Funny, though, when you ask people on the street about the Olympics, they still get really excited. Our interns Katie Pikus and Brittany Hill took to the streets of West Hartford to ask, would you like to see the Olympics come to Boston in 2024?
I would want it to come over here just because I would be able to see it. That's basically a selfish reason, but I mean, that's my only reason.
Yeah, Boston's great. I used to live there. I think it's a great spot. It will be congested, but it'll be fun.
Yes,
that'd be nice.
I think it's a great idea from my perspective, but I would probably have a different perspective if I was a citizen of Boston.
Yeah, that's the key question, huh? Today, where we live, the Olympic dream, is it worth it? As Boston throws its hat into the ring for the 2024 Games, we'll talk to one of the city's top sports columnists who says the idea is preposterous. We'll also hear from a London reporter who studied the 2012 Games there. His book is called Why the Olympics Aren't Good for Us and How They Can Be. We'll also be joined today by NPR investigative reporter Howard Berkus, who covered the 2002 Salt Lake City Games, including a bribery scandal, and also the man who made a political career out of those games, Mitt Romney. Yeah, it seems it all comes back to Boston. What do you think? Should Boston consider an Olympic bid? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to bring in first Dan Shaughnessy, who's a sports columnist at the Boston Globe. He wrote a column called Just Say No to a Boston Olympics. Dan Shaughnessy, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you heard what the people on the streets said. When you ask people about the Olympics, they just get really, really excited about it. You're not so excited. Why?
Well, again, the people who want the Olympics in Boston fall into two categories. They're either hopelessly naive, which was your man on the street interviews, and that's very sweet and nice, or they have something to gain by it, some profit margin involved in the entire enterprise. So everybody else lives in the real world, and it just does not take any kind of a, you know, urban planner, rocket scientist, what have you, to tell you that this is a colossally bad idea.
One of the main themes in your column, though, is something that I think is really important to get out of the way first. It's that you are saying out loud that, you know, Boston's a pretty great city already. We've got some stuff going for us. Often Olympics go to cities that are trying to get onto the world map. Boston should be looking at itself in the mirror and saying, we're already on the map. We don't need an Olympics here.
Well, clearly, like London and Athens didn't need to get on the world map. They still had Olympics. Atlanta needed to get on the world map. They had Olympics, you know. You know, they're still regretting it from what I understand. I was there for that one. I was in Sydney. I was in Barcelona. I think in this day and age, given the cost and the requirements of the IOC, the quote-unquote corruption or, you know, weirdness that goes around all the bids and all the spending, it's just I think this is going to be farmed out to autocratic societies only moving forward. I don't see a lot of free societies ponying up for this.
Some of the things that the IOC requests or essentially demands out of a city, things like building an 80,000-seat stadium. No big deal in Boston, right? You can fit an 80,000-seat stadium somewhere in the hub, right?
Well, that's what was so weird. We have a well-meaning committee of 11 people chaired by a construction CEO that is putting forth the bid, and they made the final four for the USOC to consider having an American city bid on 2024, and Boston's in that final four now. But I don't understand why we are still alive in this bidding, or why we would want to be.
We're talking with Dan Shaughnessy from the Boston Globe. If you have thoughts about the Olympic Games, whether or not they should come to New England, specifically Boston, or just the whole idea of the Olympics and how it's maybe changed since the idyllic world of the past, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. You ran these ideas past some business leaders. One of them told you the Olympics in Boston would probably finish off the city for good. Now, that seems a bit hyperbolic, probably as hyperbolic as someone saying the Olympics would be really, really good for the city. But do you think it could be a disaster if Boston actually did get this bid?
We could do it, but in my view, we don't want to do it. The cost is way out of proportion. And again, you just cited some of the requirements, and they're legitimate requirements of the IOC, needing the 80,000-seat stadium in town, the 150-acre Olympic Village in town, the velodrome, the aquatic center. These things, you don't just say, well, we got an Olympic-sized pool at Harvard so we can have the swimming over there. No, you need to build an aquatic center with spectators, with warm-up pools, with diving pools. I mean, it is like enormous expenditure, and when it's over, you have these things that more than likely you can't use. And we didn't have the space for them or the money for them to start with. We just went through a, 15, 20-year big dig where they suppressed the central artery. And Congressman Barney Frank, God love him, said it would have been cheaper to raise the city. I mean, it was, the big dig, it's called, and it took a long time. You can't get from Boston to Cape Cod on Friday afternoon on a regular noontime start because of the congestion traffic here. We're clogged, we're finished, we're built up, and this is not the way to go.
I want to bring in Mark Perryman. He's author of a book, Why the Olympics Aren't Good for Us and How They Can Be, editor of London 2012, How Was It for Us? He's studied and covered the London Olympics in 2012. Of course, London, a city that's probably as close to what Boston is in America as any place else. Mark Perryman, welcome to our show.
Hello.
You've heard some of what Dan Shaughnessy is saying leading up to the potential for Boston getting the Olympics. What did you hear in London leading up to the London bid? Some of the same concerns and obviously some of the same cheerleading on the other side?
Well, Jonathan described it as naivety. I mean, I think that's being polite. It's ignorance. I teach at the University of Brighton. I set my students a simple task each year. I say, go to the library and see if you can find a single piece of research, just one piece of research, which definitively proves that hosting the Olympics boosts the local economy, results in long-term employment, boosts tourism, and boosts participation in sport. And they look high and low, they search the internet around the globe, and they can't find a single piece of research that proves that. What they do find is that the impact is at best marginal, and very often negative.
That negative impact is something that people obviously don't look at in the run-up, the excitement that might accompany the games. Now that we have a little bit of time under our belts here, what are the things that people predicted before the London Olympics that came true? What are some of the things that maybe didn't come true that were predicted beforehand?
Well, if you clear all the rhetoric out of the way, if you presume that it won't result in extra jobs, but it won't boost tourism, but it won't increase in participation in sport, and what it provides is a state-sponsored party, then people absolutely buy into something which they're going to get something back. And I can remember in the weeks after the Olympics going on to phone-in shows like yourself in the UK and the presenter saying, look, you realise it cost you £300 in taxes per head. People say, I don't care. I had such a wonderful time. So if the purpose is to give the people of Boston probably the most unforgettable 4 weeks of sport in their lifetimes, then provide it. Go ahead. But don't go ahead on the basis that it will result in more jobs, increased tourism, or increased participation in sport. So you've got to separate the rhetoric from the reality. It is a fantastic party, the Olympics. And if you're willing to spend the money, and taxpayers spend the money, because the biggest single sponsor of London 2012 wasn't Adidas, wasn't British Airways, wasn't McDonald's, wasn't Budweiser, it was the British taxpayer. If you're happy to pay the taxes as a US taxpayer to provide a party for yourselves and your children, then go ahead. But don't do it on the basis that you're going to result in more jobs, more tourism, more kids playing sport.
Okay.
It won't happen. It's never happened. and it won't happen.
Well, let me put that back to Dan Shaughnessy. Maybe that's the window we need to look at this through. If indeed it's really just to subsidize a big party, something that the people of Boston will never forget, and Boston certainly has had some really wonderful parties surrounding sports, and in its recent memory, some really terrible tragedies surrounding sports as well. I mean, what do you think of that? I mean, if you just put it to people like that, would you be willing to pay for a really great party in Boston and an unforgettable moment in the city's history? What do you say, Dan?
Well, I think if you put it, I'd make that a referendum on the ballot and tell people exactly what the number would be per taxpayer, and if they're willing to pay for the party, then go for it. There's also some consequences to not just the cost, but the inconvenience of the party, the construction, the security, the anti-terrorism. There's a lot involved here. And I think in the reality of that referendum would sober up most people and say, well, you know what, we just had a city win 8 professional championships in 12 years. You know, we have all these great medical institutions and higher learning institutions. We probably really don't need to do this. You know, we can have the Esplanade 4th of July and the Marathon Day and the Pops and all that stuff. And this is a long way to go for a big party.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We will get to your phone calls in just a moment. Listening into this conversation from Salt Lake City is Howard Berkus. He's a correspondent for NPR's Investigations Unit. He's covered 8 Olympic Games, including the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002, right in his backyard. Howard, welcome to our show.
Good to be with you.
You know, as you've been listening to Dan Shaughnessy and Mark Perriman talk about, you know, these are two cities that are already on the global map. Boston may be looking to get an Olympic Games. London, of course, had the 2012 Games. These are two cities that don't need to raise their profile. Maybe you can take us back to the moment when Salt Lake City, Utah, started thinking about getting a Winter Games. What Salt Lake City was like, why the civic leaders said, yeah, this is something we should get in on.
Well, Salt Lake City at the time was a place that where people felt somewhat insecure about the reputation here. There's the dominance of the Mormon religion, which many outsiders, you know, view as strange, weird, strange liquor laws that come out of that. There was a sense that hosting the Olympics would give Salt Lake City the opportunity to say to the world, we're a community that has arrived, we're cosmopolitan, you can get a drink here, you can have fun in Salt Lake City, we are open for business. There are all those kinds of themes that were present in the bidding process leading up to Salt Lake getting the Olympics.
So those are the themes leading up to it. As you get closer and eventually as the city is chosen, talk about the process of actually then going ahead and building all of these facilities. Obviously, the requirements for Winter Games and Summer Games are quite a little bit different. The economic impacts of these two types of games are quite a bit different. But and we can parenthetically say there is some other controversy leading up to the games, which maybe we can talk about later. But talk about this idea of now we've got it. Now we've got to build. Now we've got to spend taxpayer money to actually bring the games to Salt Lake City and put on this big party, as Mark calls it.
Well, actually, Salt Lake was unique among cities bidding for the Olympics. When it was bidding, all the cities that were bidding for the 2002 and actually the 1998 Winter Games, which Salt Lake bid for and lost, were required by the United States Olympic Committee to actually begin building the facilities before they even knew that they were going to be Olympic hosts. And so there was a referendum in Utah and a spending of about $50+ million to start building a speed skating oval, a ski jump, and a bobsled and luge run before we even knew that we were getting the Olympics. This was something that the U.S. Olympic Committee required. And voters here did support that, although they were told, as your other guests have pointed out, that there would be economic benefits, there would be, you know, more jobs and increased economic benefits, and that's what the Olympics were sold on here. So those facilities were actually already built to some degree before Juan Antonio Samaranch uttered the words Salt Lake City. in announcing who won the bid for the 2002 Games. Of course, they weren't up to complete Olympic snuff. And this is really common with preparing for an Olympics. The international federations for the various sports come in and they take a look at your plans. And you may have budgeted, you know, $20 million for something. And they say, well, no, that ski hill isn't steep enough. You need to shave the mountain a bit and it'll cost you another $20 million to do that. Those sorts of things happen. That actually happened in Calgary during the Calgary Olympics. The federations have demands on the quality of the facilities. So what you may bid initially in terms of the cost can increase significantly. That will happen. But this is a city that really rallied around the Olympics. There was no Dan Shaughnessy here raising the hue and cry in advance in a very public way, raising important questions about whether the city should bid and what the cost would be and do we really want to bear those costs and what the inconveniences will be, and those are significant. There was no vocal, concerted, credible opposition here before the Salt Lake Games. The city, by and large, was very much into using the Olympics as a way to say that this is a place that has arrived, we can do it. And not only did it provide that boost eventually to Salt Lake, at least in terms of its reputation, it, you know, helped launch the political career of Mitt Romney.
And we'll get maybe to Mitt Romney in a little bit. Dan Shaughnessy, are you an outlier in this? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of cheerleading anytime a big sporting event happens in Boston. And so I'm wondering whether or not you're catching some flack or you're joining the chorus. And a lot of other people are saying, please don't bring the games here.
It's the latter. Yeah, I don't usually have a lot of people agree with my opinions. I'm not used to that.
We've noticed, yes.
But on this one, it was pretty much across the board. Very hard to find voices that support this, again, unless they're incredibly naive / ignorant, whatever. There's people, I don't know, maybe with agendas to build or to be part of this. But no, we have a pretty savvy constituency here. We have a lot of cynical people. We have a lot of smart people, whatever you want to call it. They're not buying it, and it is not being bought here by the population.
Mark Perriman, you talked about this a little bit before, but what were the London newspapers saying leading up to this? Was it mostly cheerleading, or was it an awful lot of Dan Shaughnessy's raising the caution flags?
There was a degree of cynicism. There was a degree of investigative reporting, but everything changed on Super Saturday when Mo Farah and Jess Ennis and Greg Rutherford win gold in the most miraculous evening of the British athletics in most of our lifetimes, if not of all time. Then the mood changed entirely. But if Great Britain hadn't sorted up the medal table, I think there would have been a lot more of the anxieties and the opposition. But it wasn't organised opposition. It was a fantastic. I can't stress enough. But when the Olympics comes to town, it's an incredible party. Look at Brazil. You know, okay, they've woken up from the night before after the 7-1 thrashing by Germany. But up till then, you know, the opposition was pushed absolutely to the margins because people just get whipped up into the frenzy of a party, as I was. I'm not anti-Olympics. It's great fun. I think there needs to be a dose of reality here, though. Look, since 1996, the Atlanta Games, no Games has been hosted by a city which isn't a capital, or we all think of as a capital. Everybody thinks of Sydney as the capital of Australia. Of course, Canberra is the official capital. The 2016 Games have already been awarded to Rio de Janeiro, a capital city. 2020 have already been awarded to Tokyo, a capital city. That is the IOC priority. So I'm afraid Boston hasn't got a hope in hell, because it will go to a capital city. That's absolutely the IOC's priority now. So it either goes to a capital city or the city that you think of as a capital, i.e. in American terms, New York.
And right now, the American capital city that is in the running still is Washington, D.C. Howard Berkus, what have you heard regarding this? As you look forward at other Olympic Games and you're listening to what Mark Perriman is saying, it seems as though there is this trend. Is Washington, the home of NPR, the host of the 2024 Olympic Games, likely if America gets the bid?
Well, I disagree with that notion. What the members of the International Olympic Committee look for, and there's a whole bunch of things that they look for, And by the way, the votes that they take are not public, so you never know what they actually do. What they may say to you and what they actually do in their votes could be completely different things. But what the IOC looks for is they have this notion of Olympism as a as an ideal that they want to spread throughout the world, and trying to spread to distant continents who and countries which have not hosted the Olympics before. That's a very key element there. The idea of returning to a previous host city, it happens from time to time. It happened with London. But that goes against a tide of trying to go to different cities. There were plenty of these capital kinds of cities up, you know, for 2016. Rio got it. Rio is a capital city, but most importantly, Rio is in is on a continent that hadn't hosted the Olympics before, and that's been a huge trend with the IOC. IOC members have said that very publicly. They also are looking for places, you know, that can pull together the resources that are necessary to put on an Olympics that, you know, now reaching into the billions of dollars. And that may seem to eliminate some cities over others. But what happens is, even though the bidding is done by a city, Boston, it's really the country that ends up adopting the Olympics. It's huge amounts of federal funds that go in for things like security, transportation, infrastructure, as well as some local funds, public funds for that. So it becomes a country effort. And so I think there's a lot going on there. We still may see Olympics in relatively small places in the future that though have the backing of a larger country behind them.
Mark Perriman, quickly before I let you go, this idea of a country hosting the Olympics as opposed to a city, maybe that's really what makes sense here. Maybe what the Olympics needs to be, because down the road, cities are going to see this price tag and they're not going to want to get into the games. They will have riots in the streets like they did in Brazil around the World Cup and the Olympics, whether or not they should be spending money on national services or whether they should be spending money on sports stadiums. What about changing this Olympic ideal so that America might get the Olympic Games and you can put things in various cities and actually use some of the facilities that we've already built? Do you think, Mark, that this will ever be on the table for the IOC?
Probably not, because they've got closed minds to alternatives. They've got closed minds to change. But the point is, the reason why a city hosts the Games dates back to the late 19th century. It was Baron de Coubertin, the founder of the Olympic movement. His vision was that the youth of the world, the sporting youth of the world, would live together in an Olympic village. You know, 100 and more years later, this is complete rubbish, because most of the elite athletes, they jet in from their holding camps, they do their event, they jet out again. You know, it would revolutionize the Olympics if it was hosted by a country, because for starters, take America. You wouldn't have to build a single new facility. You know, a city to host an Olympic Games has to build one new facility after another. Great Britain, we wouldn't have had to build a single new facility. And it becomes very much the Games of one particular part of a country. It doesn't become a national event. So decentralization would be a revolutionary way to change the Olympics for the better. But I'd make a more local point. I mean, globally, I would say probably the sporting event that Boston is best known for is the Boston Marathon, which is free to watch. Now, I've just had the privilege of watching the Tour de France in this country. It's free to watch. Move the Games out of the stadiums. Give the Games to the people. You know, there's one event after another could be changed so that they're actually played on the streets and in the parks of these cities, so that it's no longer a stadium event. You know, there's all kinds of ways which the Games could be changed to make it absolutely participative, a party for the whole nation rather than one part of the nation.
Mark Perriman is author of Why the Olympics Aren't Good for Us and How They Can Be. He's also editor of London 2012, How Was It for Us? Mark, thank you so much. I also want to thank Dan Shaughnessy. He's a sports columnist at the Boston Globe. Dan, before I let you go, one of the things that I find so interesting about this, it really comes back to what's happening with the World Cup in Brazil. And I think Mark mentioned this just a moment ago. Sports are fickle. And part of what happens with sports is you can have an awful lot of excitement leading up to something, and like Brazil did, and then you can go down in crushing defeat and change the entire mood of whether or not something was a good idea. As Mark said, when London had British folks up on the medal stand, everyone was very excited, and they got a big boost from that. Isn't one of the problems here is that we're dealing with a world in sports that is just so hard to nail down, and it's so hard to know whether or not this will frankly be a good experience or a bad experience in the end?
Yeah, really, for our city, it, of course, would not be about any of those things because we have American athletes. We expect to win the basketball. We're going to win a lot of medals no matter what. We're really good at the Olympics, and you don't have that sense of, oh, we've never had victory in this particular thing, and get kind of some sort of a unifying spirit behind that. That's out of the mix here. People here, they love their professional teams, and like I said before, they've had 8 duck boat parades in 12 years, and the Patriots, Red Sox, Celtics, Bruins, that's what they care about locally as far as sports goes. So you're not going to get that kind of buzz. For us, it's going to be about the logistics, the inconvenience, the building, and just the unwieldiness of putting the event here that we absolutely do not need.
His column is called Just Say No to a Boston Olympics, and somewhat unusual for him, Dan Shaughnessy is part of the crowd, all saying seemingly the same thing in Boston. He's, of course, a sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to talk to you, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll continue with Howard Berkus. He's been covering Olympics for years, and we're going to find out whether or not the Olympics are a good idea, whether or not this Olympic idea is changing. We want to hear from you. You can tweet us at Where We Live. You can call us at 860-275-7266. We're going to get to some of your phone calls when we come back, Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
The International Olympic Committee has the honor of announcing that the Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
That was the sound of London whenever they were awarded the 2012 Olympic Games. Sometime after those games are announced, well, the questions start, and then often it turns into, well, something not so exciting for the host cities. We're talking about the Olympics and the Olympic ideal here on the program today. We're joined by Howard Berkus. He's a correspondent for the NPR Investigations Unit. He lives in Salt Lake City. He's covered 8 Olympic Games, including the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics. We're going to get to some of your phone calls in just a moment at 860-275-7266. Max emails us, has there ever been a suggestion of a permanent Olympic site? Choose one site, raise money from around the world, have permanent facilities that serve as both the event spaces and training spaces for non-event years. Howard Berkus, you know, that might be against some of the Olympic ideals we talked about, but that sounds like a pretty cost-efficient way of doing things.
That comes up every Olympics, every Olympic bidding process. There are people who raise that issue of just having a single location or rotating the games among, you know, 3 or 4 locations. But that is contradictory to what the International Olympic Committee is looking for in large part when it's staging an Olympics, and that is to move the Olympics around the world so that more cities get to experience the games, more people get to experience the games, and also it's a huge revenue generator for the International Olympic Committee. One would have to wonder whether the same amounts of money would arise every 4 years if the games were held in the same place. But it certainly would be a lot cheaper because what you have now is you have cities building facilities that are at a scale, at a size, and often involving sports that may not really be able to be supported in those communities. Montreal had a swimming pool that you could ride a motorboat around in, and you know, Montreal overspent for its Olympic spending by $1 billion. It took them 30 years to pay off that Olympic debt, and every Olympic city has facilities that it built. Sometimes they'll add, you know, temporary facilities and then tear down the temporary parts later. But they have facilities that they built that you know, get used during the Olympics, but don't get much use afterwards, and often require some sort of public subsidy to keep them going.
Yeah, you just search on Google for pictures of the Sarajevo Olympic yes. sites and terrible overgrown weeds over things that were built with, I'm sure, quite some promise. And we travel quite often to the beautiful city of Montreal, where that Olympic stadium is a grand monument to failure, essentially. And it almost seems, Howard, as though that and other facilities like it mock the people of the city. Montreal, as Dan Shaughnessy talks about Boston, already one of the world's great cities, but it now has this thing it's stuck with that is a constant reminder of something that didn't work as well as it could have worked. I'm sure that there are examples in Salt Lake City and every place else where Olympic things were built.
Well, Atlanta, the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, unfortunately for the people of Atlanta, that Games is known in International Olympic Committee circles as sort of the tawdry Olympics. The reputation stemming from Atlanta was a crass commercialism that the IOC never wants to see again for an Olympic city, and that's how that Games is remembered. Salt Lake City had the very interesting situation of a high-profile scandal involving alleged bribery in advance of the Olympics, practices that actually had been documented in other Olympic cities before Salt Lake City's bid, but the Salt Lake City bidding scandal became an major international news event, triggered criminal investigations at the Justice Department, congressional investigations, triggered a very painful reform process at the International Olympic Committee and also at the United States Olympic Committee. But the reputation that Salt Lake got out of its games was a city that came together and pulled it off. IOC members and visitors from around the world just couldn't get over how friendly people were here. You know, once the games arrived, and you have to remember, too, that this was in the shadow of September 11th. Once the games arrived, it went off without a terrorist incident, which was a huge fear. There was a lot of good feeling, and there still is good feeling among IOC members and among people who attended the Salt Lake Games that you know, the city did benefit in terms of its reputation. People couldn't get over how friendly the volunteers were. I mean, you know, I live here, and I would go into the press center every day, and you have to go through a security station, and you know, my daughter's best friend's mom was manning the metal detectors, and she knew me, and you know, still she searched through my bag like she was supposed to, and you know, she had to, you know, check to make sure that my credentials were right, and I got to tell you, she was the sweetest security check I ever experienced, and other people said the same thing about the volunteers in Salt Lake and the people in Salt Lake City. Despite the scandal, it ended up being good for the city in terms of its reputation.
Somebody else who made a reputation out of the Salt Lake City Games was one Mitt Romney, who became governor of Massachusetts, made, of course, a presidential bid. He was brought in many ways to rescue the bid of Salt Lake City. Here's a little bit of what he said about his time there.
My experience as an Olympic organizer is that there are always a few very small things that end up going not quite right in the first day or so. Those get ironed out. And then when the games themselves begin and the athletes take over, all the mistakes of the organizing committee, and I made a few, all of those are overwhelmed by the many things that the athletes carry out.
Howard Berkus, talk about the Mitt Romney effect. I mean, of course, in our neck of the woods, we think of him as the former governor of Massachusetts. We call him Governor Romney. And of course, he, you know, he ran for president in the last cycle. But I don't think as many people think about just how key a role he played in Salt Lake City and how really it jumpstarted his entire political career.
Well, certainly he's claimed that in his political career. And others have as well. And I don't think there's any doubt that in the wake of the bidding scandal, the Salt Lake Organizing Committee was in disarray. Fundraising had ground to a halt. No company was willing to invest in the Olympics, given the shadow that over the games because of the bidding scandal. You know, you got to remember, we're at a point where Juan Antonio Samaranch, the head of the International Olympic Committee, is hauled before a congressional investigating committee and forced to walk through a metal detector and empty his pockets like everybody else. It was a very embarrassing time for the Olympics. And what Mitt Romney was able to do was to restore confidence in the organizing committee. He brought some fiscal discipline to that organizing committee. The games were on a track to be the games that they eventually became anyway in terms of organization, but leadership was required, visible leadership was required, and Romney did come in and set the right tone at the right time and provided the confidence that Olympic sponsors, you know, were looking for, that the International Olympic Committee was looking for, the U.S. Olympic Committee was looking for, and that the people of Utah were looking for. And I think he played that role in a significant way.
You mentioned earlier the scandal and how it dragged in the IOC and local organizers. We've heard an awful lot in reports from the New York Times and other newspapers about scandals surrounding FIFA, the governing body of soccer, and the World Cup. And I think that an awful lot of the questions that people have about the Olympics coming to any city, not just an American city, is these organizations that oversee these games, whether it's FIFA and the World Cup or the IOC, whether or not we can feel as though these are trustworthy organizations run by trustworthy people who indeed have these Olympic ideals in mind, or whether or not in some way, shape, or form, it's just kind of a money grab for them and their friends. I mean, how much has that changed, Howard, over the years, and how much did the Salt Lake City scandal change any of this?
Well, in direct response to the Salt Lake City scandal, the International Olympic Committee enacted reforms that isolate IOC members from the bidding process. So it used to be IOC members would travel the world to bidding cities and be treated like kings and princes and showered with gifts, against the rules even of the time, the gifts. But they would use the Olympics to basically tour the world and be treated like, royalty. They would get free surgery at local hospitals in bidding cities. They would get, shotguns and skis and ski trips and trips to the Super Bowl in New Orleans and you name it. I mean, as well as cash and real estate deals and free housing for their kids and college scholarships. And that just, that Salt Lake didn't invent that. That was going on long before the Salt Lake Olympics. It was discovered during the Salt Lake Games and made very public. But since then, IOC members have been isolated from that process. They're not allowed to visit bidding cities anymore. The decision is actually the early decisions and the vetting is made by a small committee, and they have very specific criteria that they're looking at. So in that way, there's been some attempt to remove the corruption that took place in Salt Lake City and before Salt Lake City. But overall, it's still the joke is that the International Olympic Committee is a kingdom looking for a country every 4 years. A former president of the IOC preferred to be referred to as His Excellency and traveled in royal style. It's an organization of people generally of privilege who very much believe in the ideals of sport and of Olympic sport and of taking that to the world. But in the process, there's an enormous amount of money involved. And anytime there's enormous amount of money involved, people make decisions sometimes for the wrong reasons. And that certainly happens in the Olympic world.
But it runs up against this not just notion, but this reality that there is so much money involved. And yes, there was so much criticism of the Atlanta Games and how tawdry it was and how it looked more like a stock car race in a lot of ways than it really looked like an Olympic Games. But at the end of the day, Howard, they're all here to make money. They're here to make lots and lots and billions of dollars of money, not just for themselves, but for others in the community, and certainly for big television networks like NBC. I guess one of the things that many people, sports writers like Dan Shaughnessy, look at and go, I can't believe these folks ride in and want to have these Olympic ideals when at the end of the day, they're just like the NBA, the NFL, and everyone else who wants to make as much money out of sport as is humanly possible.
Well, I having talked to many IOC members, believe that many of them firmly believe in what they say. That doesn't mean that they don't like you know, staying in the best hotels during the Olympics, which they absolutely do, while the athletes sometimes are in, you know, college dorms. I think they do enjoy those things. There are more former athletes now on the International Olympic Committee, recent athletes and current athletes on the IOC. It's been democratized to some degree. There are more women. There are more minorities on the IOC and more people who aren't from Europe on the IRC on the IOC. And that has helped to some degree. But look, people need to understand one thing about the Olympics. And I think your other guest said it well. It is a party that a community can enjoy for the time that the Olympics takes place. People get wrapped up in the emotions of the athletes, in the emotions of the competition and the sport, and of seeing their city portrayed in a positive way worldwide, if that's the publicity that they get, and generally they do. People here in Salt Lake City, I could, if it was wintertime and I walked out the door, I'd see 10 people today wearing their 2002 Salt Lake Olympic volunteer jackets. People are very proud of the roles that they played. Tens and tens of thousands of volunteers, people giving up their homes, you know, so that someone associated with the Olympics could stay in them, sometimes at great rent, sometimes not. There is that very, you know, that positive kind of emotional thing that comes out of a games. If you're expecting to make money, if you're expecting that your city will make money, you know, think again. But if you're willing to go through all the inconvenience and to spend all the money to have a positive experience for your community, then the Olympics may be it. And that's what you have to decide, whether all those other things are worth that experience. I think in Utah, even though they're, you know, we're subsidizing Olympic facilities that can't pay for themselves, you know, the vast majority of people would say that the Salt Lake Olympics was a very positive experience that enhanced their lives.
Of course, what I seem to be hearing here, Howard, is that, you know, in Salt Lake City, people are pretty nice. They don't seem all that cynical, and maybe that's what it takes to have a really good experience out of this. Maybe up here in the Northeast, we're just a little too jaded to really enjoy it the way we should.
Londoners are not cynical, are you suggesting? I mean, what Mitt Romney said in that audio you just played about, you know, there's a lot of complaining, a lot of cynicism, skepticism, grousing before an Olympics, early on in the games. That is absolutely true. I've covered 8 games, and in every single one of them, that has been the pattern. And then the games get going, and we get caught up in sort of the athletic events, the accomplishments, the athletes who come out of nowhere, the complete unknowns who do something miraculous, you know, whatever it is, we do get caught up in that, or many people get caught up in that, and we do sort of forget, you know, how unhappy we were. And I saw that in London. I mean, you can't come across a more cynical populace, I think, than in England. And that happened. And I think, you know, I think an Olympics could even transform the cynics and skeptics of Boston while such an event was taking place. But the questions that people are raising are very important, and people need to understand what they're getting themselves in for. And Olympic committees don't always provide that in a transparent way, don't often explain the true costs, don't often, you know, you had in your, at the top of your program, you surveyed some people on the streets of Boston, and one of the people said, "Oh, I would love the Olympics to come to Boston because I'd be able to see it." Well, chances are that person would not be able to see the Olympics. Tickets are very hard to come by. There's a Byzantine ticketing system for the games. Local people can have a very difficult time getting tickets, and they cost a fortune. So it isn't necessarily true that if the Olympics come to Boston, you'd get to see them. You still might get to see them on TV, and it'd be your city. And there may be some public event staged to help you be part of the games, but you might not even be able to get into the main Olympic Park unless you have a ticket to an Olympic event, which is what happened in London. You may have to stand outside the fence, which is what happened in Beijing. And you had thousands and thousands of people standing outside the fence because they couldn't get into the Olympic Park because they couldn't afford a ticket, or they couldn't find tickets. People need to understand what they're buying into before they agree to host an Olympics. And often the local Olympic organizers are not the best people to explain that. Mm-hmm. So it's good to have people like Dan Shaughnessy out there raising questions before a city agrees to host an Olympics.
And as we heard from Mark Perryman a little bit ago, Boston already has something. It's a free event. You can just walk up and watch. It's called the Boston Marathon. It happens once a year, and it's frankly one of the most amazing things that happens in sports in America. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Howard Berkus and try to build a better Olympics as we consider a Boston bid in 2024. Some of his ideas about how to make this a better experience. We're getting some tweets in as well about this idea of a regional Olympics. Maybe it would mean New Haven could host a soccer game, says Urban Data. A tweet from Mary who asks about whether or not a regional 2024 Olympics could jumpstart investment in regional transportation. That's something we'd all like to see. You can keep your tweets coming at Where We Live. We'll get some of your phone calls as well, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We read a column by Dan Shaughnessy, the great sports writer for the Boston Globe. It says, just say no to a Boston Olympics. Boston is one of the final cities in America bidding for the 2024 Olympic Games. It seems as though fewer cities around the world are interested in the Games. Maybe they see the sticker shock, the price tag of games like Sochi, Russia, which cost some $51 billion, or they see some of the problems leading up to games like Athens, Greece. But as we've been hearing from Howard Berkus, who's covered 8 Olympic Games, including in his hometown of Salt Lake City, there's an awful lot of good that can come out of the Olympics if you do them the right way. So in this last segment, we'll try to figure out a way to build a better Olympics. We're getting tweets from Tanya, who says, I'd love to attend a game in games in Boston. I did in L.A., but I can't imagine how the facilities would fit. A tweeter, Don, says the logistics would be even more complex if it was outside of one host city, if it got regionalized in some way. Don continues, I attended the entirety of the Atlanta 96 games, 2 magic weeks of sport, joyous people from everywhere together. Logistics were easy. Obviously, there are good stories and bad stories. Howard Berkus, in just the last couple minutes we have, help us build a better Olympics. You've covered a lot of them and you've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. What would make the Olympic experience just better?
I think that's the first time I've ever been asked that question. Well, you know, you've had people tweeting in about regionalization, and that's already done for the Olympics, especially when it comes to soccer. So the early events in soccer are spread not only across the country, but sometimes across international borders. So if Boston gets the Olympics, you might have one of the soccer events in Hartford. That's certainly plausible. What would make the Olympics better? Certainly some attempt to control size and costs. And the IOC tried that since the 2000 games in Sydney, there was an effort that they called gigantism, which sounds like a terrible medical malady, but was an attempt to reduce the size and the cost of the games, and it didn't work. It went nowhere, and that's because there are all these inherent interests in the Olympics, the media being one of the biggest. 75% of Olympic funding is paid by television rights for the Olympics, most of that coming from the United States television rights. And that brings about 10,000 to 15,000 people who are there just for the host broadcasters and the rights holders of the Olympics. They have to be accommodated. They have to be shipped around the Olympic city. That's a huge undertaking right there, just in hotel rooms. And they, by the way, demand the best hotel rooms, the Olympic hosts. They have their own international broadcast center, which has to be built, hopefully inside an existing convention center. But, you know, that's a huge cost right there. They couldn't reduce that. There's the entourages that athletes have. You know, sometimes it's not just the athlete and a coach, but an agent, their family members. I mean, you start adding all that up. And that's where a lot of the costs come from. And there's the demands for hotel space. One of the things that's regionalized at an Olympics is hotel rooms. You might end up staying 20 or 30 miles from the city that's actually hosting the games. That typically happens.
Well, yeah, that's one of the first things I think we'd have is we'd have people staying at hotels in Hartford pretty quickly if there was an Olympics in Boston.
Absolutely. Yeah. Hartford, Framingham. They'd be in Portland. I mean, they'd be all over the region. There would be ships docked in the port to house people there working at the Olympics or attending them. But so, you know, how do you fix this? There's so much money driving it. It's hard to imagine how you could effectively manage the costs. I mean, one thing is that, you know, the IOC demands all kinds of infrastructure accommodations that they're somewhat necessary. You have to have a good transportation system. But what cities typically do is they leverage the Olympics to build things that are not necessary for the Olympics.
Well, what's interesting is that's what our caller Mary was actually talking about. We would want to leverage this as much as we could. We have to leave it there, unfortunately, with Howard Burkus, correspondent for NPR. This is Where We Live.